Authentic is sponsored in whole by Voice of Prophecy.
There's just no question about it. Your ancestors were completely right when they told you life is hard. But what if you're actually making it harder than it needs to be? That's our topic on today's edition of Authentic.
Welcome to Authentic. Sean Boonstra explores real existential questions about the meaning of your life and how you can live a genuine human existence. Listen every week right here on this station or on your favorite podcatcher. Here's Sean with this week's episode of Authentic.
There's something I've been living with for decades now, and that's the fact that I've got some dead friends. Now, I know everybody's got dead friends, and the longer you live, the more likely it becomes that you're just going to lose somebody. So I know I'm not alone, but some of the friends I lost, well, it happened way too young. I mean, I'm talking about people who didn't survive their 20s and probably should have. These are young, tragic deaths. And there's just something extra heartbreaking about a young death because it seems so out of the ordinary. It's not the pattern that most of us expect. What we expect is for old people to die after living a long, full life, even though not as many people manage to accomplish that as you might think. Here in the United States, it seems like Americans between the ages of 15 and 24 are twice as likely to die as their counterparts in other developed nations like Germany, France, or Japan. Back in 2019, prior to the pandemic, almost 60,000 Americans under 25 years of age died. And out of those, roughly 21,000 were infants. 40% of deaths among young people between the ages of 15 and 19 were due to murder or suicide. And of course, it probably comes as no surprise to most people that men are more likely to die young than women are because of our appetite for risky behavior. And as a minister, I've got to say that when a young person dies, the funeral becomes that much more difficult because it just seems, well, so much more tragic. Of course, the first funeral mentioned in the Bible was conducted by parents who had to bury their son. But still, there's just something about a young death that seems completely out of place. Of course, nobody's death feels right, and we can tell ourselves all we want that death is just a natural part of the circle of life, but there's something essential, something fundamental in our hearts that refuses to accept that idea. I mean, you can apply your logic to this and remind yourself that everybody dies, and so you're going to lose some loved ones. But somehow, when those bills finally come due, the pain of loss suddenly overrides rationality, and it just plain hurts. And when the grave takes somebody young, well, the sense that we've all been cheated seems really sharp. When we lose somebody young, it seems more horrific because this is someone who never really got to start living in the first place. And that was the situation with some of the friends that I lost early on. I'm especially thinking of one guy today, I'll call him Peter, who burned to death in a tragic car wreck. And another friend, I'll call him Daniel, who committed suicide during a family dinner, where he excused himself from the table and never came back. These were terrible stories, profound losses that really hurt because they seemed so unnecessary. And in Peter's case, the unbelievable stress of losing their son took a very heavy toll on his parents' marriage. These kinds of things are just too costly for most people's emotional budgets, and in a lot of ways, it destroyed his parents' lives too. You know, I'm suddenly reminded of that scene in the Bible where David suddenly finds out that his son has been killed in battle. And it's an exceptionally heart-wrenching scene because his son died at complete odds with him. The boy had been staging a rebellion, trying to seize control of his father's kingdom, and by rights, the king's troops really had every right to kill him. But still, it's David's son, and he loves him. Now, most of you know the story. Absalom, the son, was a rather vain young man who had a reputation for being really good-looking. And he sported a magnificent mane of hair, which in those days was often considered to be a sign of virility or strength. He was the model warrior. But it turns out that his hair was also his undoing because one day, as he was riding under a tree, his hair got caught in the branches and it pulled him off his mule and left him hanging in the air, which made him an easy target for a man named Joab, the commander of the king's army, who, of course, killed the boy when he found him. It's one of the most heartbreaking stories in the Bible because, well, there's no good solution here. Absalom had to die because he'd become a serious threat to the peace and safety of the kingdom. And just letting him live probably would have resulted in untold pain and misery for an awful lot of people. And yet, it's still the king's son. And this is where David gives us a remarkable glance into the heart of God, because he has also endured a rebellion that's been perpetrated by the very people he made in his image. In fact, our foolish attempt to free ourselves from God eventually led to the brutal murder of God's only son. I mean, we executed him on a Roman cross. But the amazing thing is, we still find a God who actually mourns when you and I are touched by the ravages of death. And it's not the way that a lot of people talk about God, as if he's some kind of arbitrary tyrant who can't wait to be rid of the human race. So listen to what the Bible says about David at the moment when he discovers that his beautiful son Absalom is dead. I think I'll start reading in 2 Samuel 8, verse 28, where a messenger named Ahimaaz suddenly arrives at David's house. It says, "So Ahimaaz called out and said to the king, 'All is well.' Then he bowed down with his face to the earth before the king and said, 'Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king.'" So here we've got this guy who delivers good news to the palace. The rebellion has been squashed and the kingdom is secure. So you'd expect the king to breathe a deep sigh of relief. But listen to what he says in verse 29. The king said, "Is the young man Absalom safe?" It's not the security of his kingdom that takes center stage at this point in the story. It's the security of his boy. And of course, Absalom is already dead. And he has to be dead because there was no other choice. He wasn't about to repent. He wasn't about to change his mind and support his father's administration. And he was always going to be a problem. So the commander who killed him didn't have a choice. He had to stop this dangerous boy and he had to do it permanently. And of course, the king understands that intellectually. But still, we're talking about his boy, a young man made in the image of the king, and the father loves him deeply in spite of the pain that he's caused. And so when David receives confirmation that Absalom is gone, this is what happens next. We stop to take a break because I've run out of time, but I'll be right back after this.
Life can throw a lot at us. Sometimes we don't have all the answers. But that's where the Bible comes in. It's our guide to a more fulfilling life. Here at the Voice of Prophecy, we've created the Discover Bible Guides to be your guide to the Bible. They're designed to be simple, easy to use, and provide answers to many of life's toughest questions. And they're absolutely free. Sign up at BibleStudies.com today and start your journey of discovery.
Retirement planning can be a stressful process, but it doesn't have to be. The friendly people at the Voice of Prophecy can walk you through the entire process and explain all of your options based on your specific needs. Whether you'd like to set up a trust for income or make a gift that will benefit your loved ones and change lives through the Voice of Prophecy, we're here to help. To learn more, call 1-800-348-5993.
This is Authentic with Sean Boonstra and the Voice of Prophecy.
Just before the break, we were talking about Absalom, a talented and charismatic young man who was cut down in the prime of his youth because he'd become a serious threat to the stability of his father's kingdom. And when you find yourself faced with this choice between saving everybody or preserving your own boy, well, I'm just glad I don't have to make that kind of decision. It's a story that runs parallel to the story of the great conflict that emerges in God's universe when a considerable segment of the creation stages a selfish rebellion that threatens everybody's well-being. It's a really serious problem. David knows that if his beloved son is never going to change and he's going to destroy the peace and safety of everybody if he isn't stopped, well, there's no choice there anymore. Absalom had to go. It was the only solution to the problem. But then when David the king suddenly gets the news of Absalom's death, I want you to pay attention to what he does. The Bible says, "Then the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said thus, 'Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, if only I had died in your place. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son.'" The boy had made his father's life a living hell. But I want you to notice there's not even a hint of good riddance on David's part, or he had it coming. There's just the broken heart of a father grieving for his boy. And I'm convinced that the story is included in the Bible for a reason, because it gives us a glimpse into the heart and mind of God Himself. I mean, the way some people talk about God, you'd think that He's just like a Greek deity on Mount Olympus, hurling lightning bolts at anybody who happens to rub His fur the wrong way. It's a story we've been telling ourselves for a really long time, these tales of a vengeful, hateful God who can't wait to get rid of us. But then you open the Bible, and you find God using this horrible tragedy, the death of a king's beloved son, to help us understand what He really feels like. As I live, God says in Ezekiel 33, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked would turn from his way and live. Turn, turn from your evil ways, for why should you die, O house of Israel? The story of Absalom might be one of the best doors to open when we're wrestling with some of the hardest questions that come from studying the Bible. For example, consider the conquest of Canaan and the order that God gave to His people to go and completely annihilate some of the people who were living there. For some of us, it looks like a brutal case of senseless genocide. It seems like people are being slaughtered just because of their ethnic identity. We start to compare that to the cruel slaughter of the Armenians at the beginning of the 20th century, or the atrocities perpetrated against Tutsis at the end of the 20th century. We read a story like that and we begin to suspect that God must be some kind of cruel despot. But today I want to suggest that you can only come to that conclusion if you don't read the whole story. What we have in the pages of the Bible is a very detailed character study of an infinite God. And of course, because He's infinite, we're always going to struggle to understand Him. When it comes to grasping the infinite, you and I are kind of like a garden slug trying to understand the sounds of a Beethoven symphony. We're just not that well equipped to contemplate an eternal God. But still, there's enough detail in this Bible to help me realize that I'm probably wrong when I'm tempted to think of God as some kind of unforgiving tyrant, some kind of cruel dictator. I mean, just consider one of the most famous verses in the Bible where it says, "For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son." What we find in this book is a God who loves us in spite of what we've done to Him, in spite of the way that we've made an utter garbage dump of His creation, and that His love for us runs so deep that He was willing to give up His own Son to save us. I mean, when Absalom ended hanging from a tree, everybody knew he had it coming. It was the just reward for his rebellion. But then we see the spotless Son of God, a perfectly innocent man, also hanging from a tree, and it boggles the mind. I mean, how do we explain that? Really, the best way to read the Bible is just to gather all the evidence. Our human nature assumes that God must hate us for what we've done. But that's not what the weight of the biblical evidence suggests. I mean, not at all. What this book shows us is an utterly heartbroken father who mourns over the death of his child. Now, I know I'm not going to be able to settle this completely for a lot of people, but let me just show you a passage that the skeptics usually skip when they talk about God's command for Israel to remove the Canaanites from the land. I mean, a lot of critics have no problem quoting God's command to do that, but for some reason they breeze right past the reason that He gives. Just listen to what it says in Deuteronomy 20, starting in verse 18. God tells the Israelites to destroy these tribes, quote, lest they teach you to do according to all their abominations which they have done for their gods. So, of course, we should probably ask what these abominations were, because in light of centuries of really bad thinking about God and some really unfortunate Christian preaching, we tend to harbor the sneaking suspicion that maybe the crimes of the Canaanites weren't really all that bad. But a few chapters earlier, God explains exactly what these people were doing that brought them to the point of decision. It says in chapter 12, "When the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess, and you displace them, dwell in their land, take heed to yourself that you are not ensnared to follow them, after they are destroyed from before you, and that you do not inquire after their gods, saying, how did these nations serve their gods? I also will do likewise." And here comes the seldom quoted, but rather disturbing part. It says, You shall not worship the Lord your God in that way. For every abomination to the Lord which he hates, they have done to their gods. For they burn even their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. The Canaanites were performing human sacrifice. We're talking about people who were willing to burn their own children to death in order to appease their twisted gods. And historically, some people believe that these horrific religious rituals were often combined with, well, I'll just say rather disturbing sex acts, which included children. And you know, there comes a point where if somebody isn't going to change and they don't want to change, you've got no choice but to put an end to it. And I understand a lot of people want to believe that there must have been some other way. Maybe there could have been an educational program to convince them that burning your children to death in the arms of a steel idol is wrong. Maybe they could have been influenced by their new God-fearing neighbors to change their ways and start to value their kids. Maybe God could have... Well, we can get really creative when we want to find some reason God must be wrong. But when you read the whole book, it becomes more and more obvious that we're the ones who are wrong. Because you find this heartbroken God weeping over the loss of his children. He didn't enjoy destroying these people one little bit, and he only did it because there was no other way. Destroying people is not God's first instinct, any more than David wanted to destroy his own boy. And I know that's not enough of an answer for some people, but I also know I'm not likely going to be able to unpack it any more carefully than that with the time that we have, because there's no easy one-sentence answer, and you really have to read the whole book. There's no other way to get your mind around this. But I can promise you this. What you're going to find in the Bible is probably nothing like the stories you've been told. And now it's time for another break, but after that I want to come back and revisit the idea that death somehow cheats us and why young death seems so especially tragic.
Here at the Voice of Prophecy, we're committed to creating top-quality programming for the whole family, like our audio adventure series, Discovery Mountain. Discovery Mountain is a Bible-based program for kids of all ages. Your whole family will enjoy the faith-building stories from this small mountain summer camp and town. With 24 seasonal episodes every year and fresh content every week, there's always a new adventure just on the horizon. Check it out today at discoverymountain.com.
As you may know, the Voice of Prophecy is supported by people just like you. We provide Christ-centered programs and Bible studies free of charge so that no one is left out. If you've been blessed by these programs and would like to pay it forward, we invite you to visit vop.com/give to make your tax-deductible donation. We're equipping the world for Christ to come, and your support will make a direct impact on so many lives. That's vop.com/give.
Most of us have lost a loved one to death, and the question we wrestle with in our mind is, what exactly happens when we die? Do we go to heaven, or do we go to hell, as some people believe? Find the Bible's answer to this question in our free Discover Bible Guides. You can get them at vop.com, click on the tab that says Study, or just call us at 888-456-7933. That's 888-456-7933.
This is Authentic with Sean Boonstra and the Voice of Prophecy.
The book of Proverbs, which is really a book of collected wisdom, it opens with a metaphor. It's the personification of wisdom, who is described as a woman, much the way that the 6th century philosopher Boethius described philosophy as a woman who came to keep him company as he awaited death in a prison cell. There's this tragic scene right near the beginning of the book of Proverbs where wisdom is trying to make herself available to everybody, offering to educate us all and make our path through this broken world just a little bit easier. And it's especially addressed to young people. It's offering to spare them the heartbreak and emotional scars that invariably come from learning life's lessons the hard way through the school of hard knocks and bitter experience. And I guess I'm drawn to this passage for personal reasons, because if I look back at my own misspent youth from the vantage point of an older man, I can see a lot of missed opportunities that were put right in front of me, but I was too blind, too self-absorbed to see them. I mean, in some ways, you can describe wisdom as the stuff you wish you'd known a long time before now. And again, I don't really mean to pick on the young here, because I'm sure that when I'm in my 80s or 90s, if God allows me to live that long, I'll look back at my 50s and 60s and still find all kinds of missed opportunities, all kinds of wisdom that was made available to me right now, but I was too blind to see it. But that being said, this really is a passage that has a special application for the young. Research seems to suggest that before we turn about 25 years of age, our capacity for rational planning hasn't really finished developing. Where older adults tend to process information in the prefrontal cortex, the more rational part of the brain, adolescents are far more likely to think with the amygdala, which is where you process emotions. And that might be the reason we were much more easily swayed by our feelings when we were younger. Now, what that means is that our capacity for logical thinking, thinking through long-term consequences for our actions, hasn't really come all the way online until we're about in our mid-20s, which would explain some of the stupid things I did when I was a younger man. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but sometimes when you ask a young guy what he was thinking when he did something dumb, like try to beat the train at a railway crossing, he's sometimes at a loss to give you any kind of logical answer, and that's because there isn't one. Sadly, as in the case of my good friend Peter, the act of living by impulse means that sometimes we have to go to a really tragic funeral. You know, I don't really know what was going on the night he died, but I do know they were on the wrong side of the highway, and I do know it was Saturday night, and I do know that Peter had a taste for partying. If he had lived to 50 years of age, he probably would have slowed down long enough to consider what would happen if you mix alcohol with driving. But he was 19. And on that night, his party brain was speaking much more loudly than his rational brain. It's a phenomenon that has caused a lot of anxiety for an awful lot of parents because their kids just don't seem to understand how dangerous and life-changing some of their decisions are. And that's where this passage from Proverbs really speaks to me, because from this vantage point, 30-some years after the fact, I can see myself in here. Let's just read from Proverbs chapter 1, where it says, "Wisdom calls aloud outside. She raises her voice in the open squares. She cries out in the chief concourses. At the openings of the gates in the city, she speaks her words. How long, you simple ones, will you love simplicity? For scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge." All the wisdom we need to successfully navigate life has been made available to us, and the Bible says it's completely free. But most of us, if we're honest, we ignore it. It's as if the world's best personal assistant is begging to work for you and he doesn't charge a penny, and you don't want him. It's as if Warren Buffett offers to manage your personal finances for free, or Bill Gates or Steve Jobs offers to be your personal IT director for $1 a year, but you turn these guys down. What you hear in this passage from the book of Proverbs is an awful lot of the same gut-wrenching heartbreak you hear in David's voice when he discovers that his foolish son is dead. You find the tears of a loving God who watches the way we mindlessly destroy ourselves, and we destroy each other, and all the while, he's freely offering to be our personal life coach. All this wisdom is here for the taking, he says, and nobody seems to want it. It's as if some generous benefactor offered to underwrite your entire college education, paid in full, no strings attached, but you'd rather go into crippling debt working 2 or 3 jobs while struggling to stay awake in class. It just doesn't make sense to pass this offer over. And it makes me wonder just how much of what I've had to learn the hard way could have been learned the easy way. How many of the cuts and bruises on my soul are completely unnecessary? When I read this, I tend to picture wisdom weeping as she's calling to an unresponsive crowd. And I guess I think about it like that because of what I know about God from the rest of the book. A loving father who weeps over our unnecessary pain, wondering why we reject him all the time and seem to want to learn our lessons the hard way. I mean, here's what it says just a few verses later. It says, "Yes, if you cry out for discernment and lift up your voice for understanding, if you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God." You've got to wonder, why in the world would anybody want to refuse an offer like that? I'll be right back after this.
Dragons, beasts, cryptic statues. If you've ever read Daniel or Revelation and come away scratching your head, you're not alone.
Voice of Prophecy's free Focus on Prophecy guides are designed to help you unlock the prophetic mysteries of the Bible and deepen your understanding of God's plan for you and the world around you. You can study online or request them by mail. Visit BibleStudies.com and start bringing prophecy into focus today.
You toss and turn in bed and find yourself awake in the middle of the night. Your mind is in turmoil and you're overstressed with the stuff of everyday life. You need peace and calm in the middle of the storm. The answer you need is found in our free Discover Bible Guides. You can get yours by contacting us at VOP.com. Click on the tab that says Study or call me at 888-456-7933. That's 888-456-7933.
Welcome back. It's Authentic with Sean Boonstra and the Voice of Prophecy.
I think one of the most frustrating things our parents must have gone through is when we started to branch out on our own. That moment when it seemed like making independent choices was more important than making good choices. I mean, it was easy to see that we were doing the wrong thing, and they often tried to save us some pain, but we couldn't hear our parents. And of course, I'm older now, but still when it comes to the wisdom of God, I have to ask myself, am I still doing the same thing? Do I value my independence over God's wisdom? In hindsight, as I'm reading the Bible, I can see that I've accumulated some really unnecessary scars. And I can see that the one who inspired the Bible really did know what he was talking about. You know, I think one of the biggest reasons people tend to push the Bible aside is because, well, it has a way of hurting our pride. I mean, it's telling us we're wrong. And so when somebody tells us that God must be treating us unfairly, there's a little part of our sinful being that wants to believe that. But then when you really start to read what God's been trying to tell us, you discover that he was never trying to take away your personal autonomy. What he's been doing is trying to set you up for a much more fulfilling, much more rewarding, authentic human life. And you start to realize that life in this world is always going to be hard, but it's often harder than it needs to be. You know, today I can look back and see all these people who were trying to help me succeed in life. They were trying to spare me the pain that they had suffered, and I find myself now wishing that I had listened a little more. Now that I'm living on the sixth floor of life, it occurs to me that if life should continue, I might be able to spare myself a lot more heartache just by listening to the cry of God's wisdom. Look, I know that some of you have already made up your mind about this book, and you've written it off as meaningless. But what if this book really is your creator, trying to set you up for a much better future, trying to keep your scars to a minimum? It would seem to me, in that case, that ignoring this book could prove to be another foolish decision. Thanks for joining me today. I'm Sean Boonstra, and this has been another episode of Authentic.
You've been listening to Authentic, sponsored by Voice of Prophecy. Remember, you can listen every week right here at the same time. And thank you. Authentic is funded by listeners just like you. You can support at voiceofprophecy.com. That's also where you can find all the episodes you missed, or where you can listen again. That's voiceofprophecy.com.